Hey everyone, thanks for checking out the Edmentum podcast, where we talk about trending topics in the education industry. Today, host David Cicero talks with Dr. Robin Kay, the interim dean of the Faculty of Education at Ontario Tech University. Today, they're discussing what educational technology research says about what's important when evaluating edtech tools. Enjoy!
So many of you have used technology in your classrooms. I have as well when I was teaching. And there are so many promises, it seems, to pulling in technology in education. These promises are things like results, higher engagement, graduation rates increase, higher attendance. Sometimes it's deeper understandings for your students or save times for teachers. But as many of you know, no matter what any vendor tells you, no tech is an out-of-the-box solution. Not today, anyway, maybe not ever. So how do we realize those promises? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that the journey begins with learning how to simply think about technology and education. And I've got a guest today that's going to help us do that. Dr. Robin Kay is a full professor and interim dean at the Ontario Tech University in Canada. His research spans classroom response systems, gender differences in technology, mobile and online learning, and the list seems not to end. He's at the edge of knowledge in terms of integrating technology in schooling, and I'm humbled and excited to have him on today. Dr. Kay, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I'm going to start with what I found in your research called the learning object evaluation metric. If any of the listeners want to do a little digging and find this paper, the paper is entitled A Multi-Component Model for Assessing Learning Objects, the Learning Object Evaluation Metric. Now, we're not going to go through that paper today, but there are a couple of topics in there I really wanted to draw out. Now, every day I speak with educators about potential technology solutions. So many schools are looking for tech and they need some way to evaluate it. And sometimes they're even going head to head with pilots with two different solution providers. Now, in that paper, you focused on a few topics to evaluate. Those were interactivity, design, engagement, usability, and content. I think just having a conversation about what these things mean are going to really help our educator listeners think about what they should be looking for, striving for, and maybe it'll, you know, help them make some better choices. And so in terms of research and your personal ideas on the topic, what is interactivity in ed tech, would you say?
Well, it's a variety of things. I would, if I was going to narrow it down to two, I would suggest that there's an engagement or motivation part in that interactivity, so that a student might be excited or interested in what's going on. And then there's actually what I would call a cognitive component, which is really what we're looking for, I think. And the two can go hand in hand, but it's really interacting with the content, perhaps constructing information or constructing models, engaging in what-if scenarios, perhaps talking with peers about what's going on, maybe sharing a document and constructing something together. So there's something that's a little more meaningful, or that it is engaging in the mind as opposed to just the affective or emotional aspects. So I break it down to those two areas. I mean, it's somewhat simplified. And I would say that summarizes, and I would also say that we're often as educators, and I've also fallen prey to this, to being seduced by the kind of emotional or excitement aspect of a web-based learning tool or an online learning tool or an app or whatever. And we have to check ourselves and say, okay, that's great. The students are interested in, or seem to be excited, but just being excited isn't going to help them learn. I could bring in cookies and cakes and they would be excited and I would have that, but that doesn't mean that they're learning. And ultimately, I think we want them to be learning and excited about that learning.
Sure. And even sometimes bringing any technology in the classroom gets kids excited.
Yeah, well, it's actually interesting, and you have to be careful. I've done a lot of research on that, and students are very candid about their feedback, which was wonderful. We ask for anonymous feedback all the time about what's going on, and a number of comments are, we're just glad to be doing something different than taking notes, or glad to be just engaged in anything. So, you know, it makes our interventions look pretty good. Now, there are lots of reasons why they like it other than just that change, but you're quite right. Sometimes just work. When we first introduced clickers, you know, I guess people use Kahoot now. There were physical clickers you had to pay a lot of money for. And students went out of their minds because they could actually interact and answer questions. But there's other ways of using it. But yeah, it can get pretty exciting. But if it doesn't lead to learning, then yeah, it's actually a distraction. So
okay. So just that excitement alone, we can't make any judgments about interactivity. Right. If they would continue to be engaged in that solution, it's just, it might be that initial excitement.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, you know, you can be interactive, but it can also actually go against learning. I'll give you an example. Something like Kahoot, which allows students with their mobile phones to answer questions. You can use it at the end of a class. Did they get a certain content? And generally, it's a really exciting tool to use. Adults and kids get pretty excited, but they also get kind of silly because you can answer in different, you can put in different names and it becomes competitive. And so it's who gets the top score versus whether you got something correct or not. And you can feel that it's almost a frenzy in the class at times. And but that's actually, it's interactive, but it's actually undermining learning. So
in that specific example, let me see if I'm getting what you're getting at here. That okay, they're interacting with the technology, but their focus is on, in that case, maybe being number one, answering first. And so they're interacting with the competition, but that's not saying their reward is not intrinsic. Their reward is not coming from interacting with the content, with the material.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it's in this situation is because it's timed. So you get the algorithm is that you get something for getting the right answer, but you also get something for doing it quicker than anybody else. And so what happens is sometimes people make premature clicks on something. They say B and they want to do it faster, and B is a possible solution, but D is better, and they don't take the time to think about it. And there are much better ways to do that. You could have groups using a clicker, take out the competition, and have them discuss and agree upon solutions. So that might work, particularly for more complex things.
Sure. So you broke it down into two categories, this idea of interactivity. You said interest, cognitive. I think that you weighed in on the cognitive side pretty well. When you say interest, are you talking about, okay, so, you know, the chances that, let's say, average high school student is just interested in mathematics for mathematics' sake, I wouldn't say that's extremely common. Are you talking about the way it's presented, interested, if it's, Are we talking about personalized learning? Are we talking about if a kid likes basketball, it's being presented to him in terms of basketball? So what do you mean by interested?
Sorry, I used that a little bit too loosely. So let's just talk about affective or emotional engagement versus cognitive. And when I used interest a bit loosely, because you can have interest in something that's intrinsically interesting, and it can also be sort of like, wow, that's cool looking, or that's shiny, and that's, you know, so, sure. or that's something I'm, you know, grabs me in a sort of a visceral emotional sense. So there's that kind of motivation of like, yeah, I'd really love to learn how to use computers because I'm going to be a video, bringing a design video games or whatever. And so there's that kind of initial, this is kind of, this could be fun. And then there's the cognitive engagement or the getting down and really kind of what's involved in this and what are the steps that I need to know? And what's the, you know, there might be higher level concepts and there might, you know, all kinds of things that where you are using your mind versus sort of your emotions, I guess.
Sure. So yeah, develop, you know, when you finally ask that question, like, I wonder how that really works. Now I'm interested.
Yes.
Right? Now I'm interested in
that,
doing
that. Then you're shifting into cognitive engagement, but you know, it's probably not two distinct groups because if I'm motivated by something, that can kind of feed, you know, this is like, oh, now that is more interesting. And as they get cognitively interested, I may get a little more excited. And so, you know, they kind of go back and forth and play with each other.
So if I was looking at something and I wanted to kind of judge its interactivity, since we're talking about the interested side,
sure.
Let's stick with that idea. What would I be looking for to say, this is likely to kind of get kids interested in the content, and in you know, how would a presentation of content do that, inspire that kind of interest in you know, your opinion or your experience?
Well, you know, based on the research that you were talking about there, and we sort of shifted to mobile apps because they used to be called learning objects, but it's not a very sexy name, so we moved to mobile apps or online tools or whatever. So it was pretty clear back then, and maybe it's less clear now, but you could have some very archaic, old-looking apps with very poor visuals and a ton of text and video interaction, that the look of it is kind of like, I don't really want to go on. And then there might be a theme that you'd have to be really careful with, particularly say with kids that were grade 7 and 8, because if it was too, what they referred to as kiddish, too juvenile, they would get discouraged. They would think, well, this, I'm not going to bother with this. Like, this is, you know, there's whatever, dancing bears or something that was sort of well below what they might be interested in. And of course, that's an insult at that age because they're growing up. And but if it's an engaging theme that is presented, in a reasonable example, that would be something like Prodigy, which is an attempt to have a kind of a simulated world of interactions where you move on in a game-like way. And then you have to answer math questions, which is a little bit odd, but at least, you know, there's at least that attempt, and kids do stay with that so that they would probably find that, you know, if any kind of, visual, interaction or attraction is generally when kids are grabbed into it.
Yeah, sounds like I could be way off on this, but I'm working on this kind of larger idea here. It sounds like part of what you're saying is that in the example you gave, it sounded like students were interested in the system that was delivering the content. Like they got drawn into the
right,
drawn into the tech. They were interested in the tech also. Like,
well, yeah. But I think it's more, I mean, if you look at it in simple terms, it's just, it's the shiny cover, you know, what is that looking, it's something that I'd want to even take a look at. And it's as simple as that versus, you know, and then once I get into it, I mean, the old, you can't tell a book by its cover, they'll make some more decisions about, well, this is lame or this is actually interesting. And so, and the more sophisticated, that is more engaging, but that's not necessarily the case. And it's expensive, right? You get into usually when you get that kind of programming, I mean, that's why the education world is drooling about gaming, because that is actually, kids will spend hours on that, right? And they're doing really interesting stuff. They're problem solving. They're actually researching, figuring out how to get through games. They're collaborating. They're doing all the things that we want them to do, but it's on learning how to be better at a particular game, which isn't what we want. We want more academic kind of stuff. So they try to merge those two. It's really difficult.
I mean, if a student was doing that, I kind of see, and what you've described, it's kind of like sweeping the content under, you're kind of, you're getting the content in there. They're really engaged in the game part, more so maybe than the actual content, but they're still consuming the content.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem, really? I mean, does that affect the way they will later use that information?
It could. It depends what you want to, the purpose of learning. If sometimes we want to get some base content that actually is rather dry, maybe something in mathematics where there's more routine skills that you want to get sort of comfortable with before you attack higher level concepts. And there's no exciting way to actually do that. So this is, it's a hard sell, mathematics.
Well, math in particular.
Math in particular. And unless you are truly interested in mathematics, and you could be, but so sometimes that's the case where they're not that engaged. So this is a way of doing it. The problem is it's really expensive to try to merge the scholastic content with fun, in terms of, that's a whole other question about the kind of curriculum that we have and what we could do that would be far more interesting for students than sticking to our subject areas and distinct classrooms and such. So that's a bigger problem. But the one thing you were talking about, like the sort of shiny surface or what I mentioned, is that actually happens a lot in mobile apps. So they do a great job of it. It looks fantastic. But really, if you get down to it, this is computer-assisted instruction that was done 30 years ago. You get it right, you get it wrong. And your rewards are a little sexier looking and there might be some competition board or something. But it's essentially that, and now sometimes thrown in with a little what they would say AI, which is just adjusting. If you're getting everything wrong, then we'll pop you down a level because that's not going to be fun for you to do that. So, but really, a lot of apps are not anything more than a content presenter. So
I had a professor in college. I was a math professor. I ended up majoring in mathematics, and largely because I really identified with him. I liked him. I thought he was a cool guy. He was so nice and he was so knowledgeable, and I kind of wanted to be like him in a way. And he was an older gentleman. He was balding and he had white hair just on the very back of his head, and he'd walk around campus and in dad jeans and pull around a rolling backpack. Okay. My point is this: when I saw that guy, he wasn't shiny. He wasn't a shiny. The entrance to that subject was not shiny because it was him, right? And so I wonder. And I was inspired. I did well. I got my degree in mathematics. And so I wonder a couple things now that I'm speaking to you about this. The first thing I'm wondering is, were we more intrinsically motivated before? Number one, kids. Number two is, do you think that, you know, we present information, and that initial presentation means a lot. Is it digitally beautiful? Is it engaging visually? Is it easy to look at? I wonder, do you think if that initial representation is so engaging that when you get down to the mathematics part, it's kind of like, you know, how are you gonna take her away once she's seen Rome? Mm-hmm. You know, if we bring the kid way high up and then it drop way back down, expectations are changed because of that initial, what they see initially, and then when they say, oh yeah, this is still just math.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Well, I think one of the, you know, was it, you asked about back in the olden days, was it we were more intrinsically motivated? I'm not sure. That's an interesting question, but I would say that in general, and this is just me observing things, not anything to do with my research, that the world is definitely more guided by sharper, more enticing imagery, videos, presentations. It seems, and modifications, right? I mean, we don't even know what is kind of real anymore, right? Because it's very hard to judge. And so, yeah, that kind of pushes the superficial maybe versus the intrinsic side. Now, the other question is more of a pedagogical one, if you want to get people interested in things. Because if you think about it, just, you know, look around your room or almost any area, there's very few things that haven't been created with basic or some very sophisticated mathematics. It's almost hard to find anything, the creation of doors and windows and carpets and all those things. There's a lot of math going in there. But the kind of math we teach is pretty disconnected from any authenticity, any reality. And so there's a guy named Dan Myers, well worth looking up, has done a TED Talk, a very engaging fellow. And he says, you know, he's given the task of engaging and enticing students in a subject area they have no interest in, and he teaches math, and so that becomes a challenge. And he sets up these very intriguing scenarios where they're sort of puzzles, and it's quite amusing the way he does it, but it's very real world. So, you know, how long would it take to fill up this pool if you had a hose and the flow, and, you know, very kind of that may be not that engaging, but that, you know, he sets up a scenario where you look at it and you think, I wonder. And then he says to the students, okay, figure it out. What do you think? And they have to work in groups and try to, and so by throwing a problem at them without saying, okay, here are the steps. You do this, 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 and there you solve the problem. Well, that's no fun. It's more fun if you kind of engage in something and say, huh. And I would imagine even in your math class, there are probably a lot of, there were moments you were puzzling and trying to figure things out. And it wasn't that you could just get a whole bunch of problems done correctly, particularly at a university level. It was actually, there was a little bit of wonder there or a little bit of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And if you can turn things around that way, then you can move towards intrinsic motivation. It doesn't really have anything to do with the technology one way or the other. The technology can help and augment, or maybe it offers certain affordances that make things a little easier to become curious or to research, right? You know, so I have to figure this problem out. And so you're estimating, and they were called, the result, oh, before that, they're called Fermi problems, like, some sort of, how many golf balls can you fit in this situation, or, you know, a big vat or something, you had to, or the jelly beans in the jar or whatever, you know, where you're trying to estimate and figure things out. Mm-hmm. And they can be very good problems or interesting problems linked to social justice, for example. One of my colleagues does that. And so you can build intrinsic interest. There are so many things to be interested in, but unfortunately, with mathematics, for example, we strip it down so much that it's like, okay, I got an answer right and I'm doing well, but, and yet think about it. Like if you have a lamp in your room, I'm looking at that, well, how was that created? And when I start looking at these things, I think, what am I doing? I mean, I couldn't do any of this, not what I'm doing, but that I'm in awe, you know, and there are people that are really, you know, use mathematics to very interesting levels, you know, so.
I like that idea. I mean, just it's very, very simple. Like you said, if you look around anywhere you're sitting right now in your room, there is math. I mean, it's almost cliche. We've heard that before. Math is everywhere, right? But it literally is. But then when we present it in many cases, it's no, math is in that book, right?
Yes,
but no,
absolutely.
But
yeah.
You know, that's how it, okay. Do students realize that there is math everywhere, and we can, I don't know the answer here, but just if I think you're right, we're sort of the teaching of mathematics. Now we're talking about teaching mathematics, of course, but the teaching of mathematics is very disconnected to what math actually is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Well, and that could be a lot of subject areas. There's a lot of pressure on teachers. And I know, in the United States, it's, you know, the emphasis on standardized testing, and it's more and more here as well, can actually really kill the enthusiasm, because it's literally focusing on answers to do well in this test. And yes, you could get that intrinsically, but it doesn't feel like it's very efficient. I mean, how many teachers with the content that they have to, in double quotations, cover, do they feel that sort of natural, well, let's just sit down and take a look at this. Let's explore, take some time, you know, and really think about this. You know, they're thinking, if I don't cover this, I don't cover this, I'm going to fall behind, and my report cards are coming up, and there's this standard. And so there's this incredible systemic pressure that makes it difficult, and it undermines, you know, these are big issues, but it undermines learning in a way that focuses on intrinsic value and what we do as adults. If you, as an adult, you don't put pressure on yourself. You start to look at something, you're curious, you explore, you ask questions of your peers, you might join a group, you know, and it's something you're interested in. We don't do that with students. We tell them, hey, you're doing this at this period, and it's good for you. So right. Off you go. And if you do well, okay, we're sort of guaranteeing that you'll move on to the next stage. But yeah, it there's lots of problems there. And you know, getting it back to the technology, there's lots of ways of evaluating apps, and there's, you know, carefully looking at the kinds of things that I talked about, you know, navigation and content and those kinds of things, and you can look at it, but ultimately it's going to be the pedagogy and the strategies in the classroom, the teaching strategy of using that tool, that are going to bring it to life and help make it meaningful. The tool will help, but there has to be a set of learning goals and thinking about how do we use this in the most meaningful way, because a lot of apps don't and tools don't do it all. They can't. So if I'm doing something, having a like I talked about the clickers, a really good way of doing that is having four people vote on an answer, right? And there's like four different answers, and you write it through, and there's this split. You know, some people think it's A, and some people think it's C. B and D are obvious wrong answers, and then you get them vote again. But you have a debate and they say, no, we think it's this. And why do we think it's that? That has nothing to do with the technology, but the technology does actually help because it shows an instant sort of class vote and what people are thinking. So, you know, it's augmenting. They work hand in hand, the pedagogy and the technology. That's probably the biggest thing that I've come to my conclusion over all the years of getting wowed by technology is actually, it's not so much the technology, it's how it's being used. And that's the focus that I would have. It's worth looking at apps though too. I mean, in a basic sense, I'm talking a bit too much here, but the navigation, for example, in an app or anything, if it's so bad that students get lost, then it's never going to work. So you have to assess it at that level as well.
Right. And that's probably a part of usability.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
But I like, look, you know, I like what you're saying here. You know, you have taken a look at, I haven't gone through all of your research. There is a lot of it. You've taken a look at interactivity, design, engagement, usability, taken a look at content in terms of evaluating online technology tools for education. In addition to that, okay, you have taken a look at student attitude, you know, confidence, low motivation, and what you're saying now, I love that, you know, we benefit from the conclusion of all of this hard work you've done, because you're kind of saying, these things are important, right? I mean, if we look at interactivity, if we look at usability, okay, if the navigation's horrible, you'll know it's horrible. So, you know, check it out. You know, you go and make sure navigation is good for, is easy for students to understand, is easy for teachers to understand. All right. Is it interactive? Is it ugly? Is it not ugly? Approach the way the content is presented. Are there opportunities for students to work together? What kinds of questions are being asked? Are they being drawn into the content? So all those individual characteristics, they're important. But now what you're saying now is, you know, after we've looked at these things, after I've spent time doing research on these individual pieces and thought about them and meditated on them, and you and your colleagues, that what it really ends up boiling down to, the most important thing is how it's being used by the teachers and students, right?
Yeah.
And so all that work is not for naught, right? We were realizing, okay, I guess, you know, the gender differences, I mean, there are, but they're not the most important thing. The most important thing is what I found later in your research was this question that is on your mind today, I think, is under what environmental conditions are these web-based learning tools more or less useful? What does the environment have to look like in order for this to be successful, in order for learning to take place? So I'm not sure if what is your take on that? If you just had to think about what the environment would need to look like, of course, I don't intend for you to lay out every single detail, but what is the first thing that comes to your mind, you know, that just needs to be so in an environment for learning to take place when technology is involved?
Well, there are a couple of things. And what you referred to there is what I would call instructional wrap. So how am I wrapping this technology? What's going on there that, you know, how am I setting the stage up? And a lot of teachers know how to, it's delivering, not delivering, but engaging or developing a good lesson. So there's a couple of simple things when you in your environment, you want to make things as easy and quick in terms of actually getting to the learning. So I've seen this, and it takes a lot of work actually to bring technology into the classroom, which is maybe why, and I mean time, and I mean thinking it through and considering possibilities and so teachers must, some teachers probably think, well, is this worth it? Because, you know, this is twice as long as it normally takes to develop a simple lesson. So anyway, if you're thinking about this, simple things like if you want them to go to a web-based learning tool is have a really shortcut, easy click or link or set it up on a, so that there's it's fast. Not that I'm typing in. You have five-year-olds or great, you know, the people that can't barely type and they're trying to type in these long addresses. And I've seen this before, and it's 10 minutes before they get into it. It's kind of like, I don't know if you, I've done home repairs and I'm like, oh, I'm ready to go and I can't find my tools. And I'm half an hour later, I finally found the tools and I've lost the enthusiasm of the thing. So you, simple things like that. And most good teachers are able to kind of really, okay, anticipate those things. I want you on this tool as quickly as possible. I want to communicate to you, if you want to do a condition of, what are the learning goals here? This is what we're doing today. Here's the big picture. And so we all have in mind what we're trying to do, whether it's what I mentioned to you before, we're going to solve this kind of problem. And it's a bit open-ended. And so it might be a little uncomfortable at first, but we'll get through this. And so that's a second thing, is that you have to, everybody's kind of rowing in the same direction in terms of where you're going. Those are just simple things that you do in any lesson, you should. But it is an important condition, because if people don't know why they're doing something, it's like, what do you, you're giving me this tool and I'm just going to keep going through this and I'll learn something. That's not really much of an enticing thing. So, and actually having some sort of engaging minds on activity or hook to kind of say, okay, this is really important. So they get into it. Again, that's in any lesson. You know, you want to make sure the technology is working. I think, you know, if you want to, the kind of conditions to really maximize learning is you do want things to be a little bit collaborative. So, you don't want students way off task, but, you know, it can be in pairs. It could be as many as four, depending on what was going on. That kind of, and that the collaboration is necessary. It's not just, we're with each other and
busy kind of work,
and it's two completing busy work. I guess it's not quite twice as fast because you're probably talking, but and then I think having some sort of engaging task that students, where they get to create or build or construct, that's kind of ideal. Now, that doesn't all learning goals, because sometimes it's basic knowledge, so you have to shift. But in terms of ideal conditions, when they get to do those kinds of things, students are most engaged. And when they get some leeway and choice, that's especially this generation, it's a very, it can be maximally useful in terms of technology. And the last thing that I would say is that the teacher cannot be up at the desk or whatever doing other kinds of tasks and not monitoring what's going on. And that's for a couple of reasons, obviously for behavior, but more importantly, I think going around engaging with the students, asking them questions, seeing if they're, you know, you have this plan, making sure that the plan's working, that they're not getting stuck, helping them when they so those kinds of things are really helpful in any learning environment, but they're very important with technology, because things can go wrong and people can get stuck on issues. So you need that kind of rotation, and technology is most useful, I think, when students are engaged in the way that they can create and design, construct, build, and that they actually have this choice of the direction they're going. Those are kind of attributes for any good learning. That's my ideal classroom. You know, that's a little tricky, and sometimes with this, we have a 40-minute classes. Good luck with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to call out something that you mentioned there. You mentioned one of the important parts of this environment or this learning experience when we have students, you know, going on technology to learn is being able to explain to them why they're doing it. This is what the goal is for today. And so I'm wondering what you think of that when the learning is asynchronous, right? When you have, you might have a student, you have a, let's say you've got a class full of students, because one technology tool that I know a lot of our audience uses is more of a online course, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it's self-paced. So you might have one student in unit one and another student in unit two. So, you know, what do you think about, how does that change your thinking when you're not talking about just pulling in a tool to leverage to get a point across, right? How does that?
That's a good point. And so that's, you know, it's what environment we're talking about. I was thinking face-to-face and on online, and we do, that's actually one of our specialties up here. That's half, two-thirds of our program are done on online, but synchronously. And one of the things that you can do is you could form groups. So people can, like what we would call, you know, as teachers, professional learning groups. So you can have professional study groups where they actually have partners that are maybe a group of four that they can kind of rely on. It's much, you know, we're meeting in Zoom. We could be meeting Google Meet or any of these tools that can be very helpful. And so that could, that's one area that you could do, be helpful. The second thing I think is, and I make, and that's one of the areas I'm intensely involved in, is video podcasts and using them in different ways. And it's not just like look up the video and do this. It's actually being engaging with the students. So for example, all my assignments, I do a video on the assignments. I talk about it. I say what I'm looking for, and I go into detail. It's, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, probably twice as long as anybody wants to look at, but it gives them the details when they want to do it. And I'm speaking to them. I speak as if I'm talking to one of them, not as a class, and saying, well, what you want to do, make sure you focus on that, because that's going to be really important. So that kind of personalizes it. And I do those videos all the time, little short ones with me personally. They're not particularly professional. They're very conversational. They're, when I say professional, it's not like a big production value. Sometimes that can actually take away from learning because they don't feel like it's personalized. And the other thing I do, and it's a little bit different, is I give actually video feedback on things. So I'll do a screencast. I'll be looking at their work. I'll give them some written feedback, but I also point out, and I say, well, that's interesting what you did there, particularly if they're doing something with technology. You know, well, I like that, like what you did with the tool here, and that's kind of, but you might want to do this and that kind of thing. And so that just goes over extremely well with all age groups, because it takes the very impersonalized feel of an online learning tool, particularly if it's online learning, particularly if it's asynchronous, and it helps make it more personal. And the last thing I would say is, if they're using a tool, for example, I still can set the stage with a video. I can set the stage with some sort of a structured sheet to ask questions. And if it's possible, I can get them to work with other students to, you know, use something that's a shareable document, like a Google Doc, so they can kind of construct and work on things together and review. So that if I can increase interaction that way with collaboration, that's particularly useful. So those are some ideas off the top of my head if I was setting up that environment that we found particularly successful with our programs.
Yeah, and it totally makes sense, because especially if students are learning online, they might be remote, right? Maybe not in a classroom. You're fighting against it not being that personal. And so I think the big sort of driving idea is, okay, how do we keep it personal? How do we keep making connection between teacher and student? Mm-hmm. And those were some great ideas. I love the, I had seen a little bit of the sort of introduction to the topic through a video, but not the feedback portion. I really like that. Because of course, everyone knows you can record all the intro videos without knowing who I am. you can't record the feedback without knowing what
no.
I know, right? So that's especially interesting. One of the things that we had talked about when you and I chatted the other day was really interesting to me. You talked about in your, I think you said in one of your graduate programs, you take time to sort of stop and meet and kind of take stock of where everybody's at, or you have some defined meeting times with students. And so I work with a lot of schools that here's sort of the scene. You'd walk into a classroom and there's 20 students in the classroom and they're working on their online course. And there's a facilitator in the classroom. Mm-hmm. That facilitator may be an expert in mathematics, let's say, or language arts. There could be various subjects being learned in the classroom, however, right? And I kind of liked this idea of, even though you're going to have kids progressing not at the exact same pace. Some are going to be ahead and some are going to be a little behind, but they're going on at their own pace. And I thought that idea that you had mentioned, do you remember that idea? You mentioned in one of your graduate programs, you kind of have a meeting time every week or every other week.
Oh, for us, we run our program synchronously. So mm-hmm. That's a really challenging, it's probably one of the top challenges for someone doing an online course is to rigidly schedule the time that they're going to spend on the course and assignments. Because what happens is you're busy and there's all these other fires that you're putting out and doing, and you sort of think, oh yeah, I got that, I've got to do that. And it becomes 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So we in our courses, they're synchronous so that we meet every week at the same time, 6 to 9 on a Monday for that course, or it doesn't have to be that long, but and we use we use Adobe Connect, which is a pretty sophisticated tool that allows us to have breakout rooms. So small rooms where people can go into and interact and then come back to the bigger group. We use Google Docs and Sheets and things like that where they can interact and develop and create things. And so there's a lot of engagement, but there's also this sort of sense of social or I don't know, aligned purpose. You're not alone, because I think you do feel a bit of alone in asynchronous, so that it doesn't have to be every week. I mean, it could be every other week, but that you actually go and you say, hey, David, you know, how are you doing? Oh, I'm struggling with this. And it's hard, you know, you don't think you're going to build relationships, but you do. And then there's actually more natural partnerships, because outside of class, we could say, did you get that on, you know, even if we're at a different pace. I know that sometimes some people can go through asynchronous courses really quickly. And so, but I think that's probably rare than that might be. We like the illusion of, like, we're going to go at our own pace and our own time and do it anytime we want. Well, it turns out we don't do it at any time, because we keep procrastinating and the pace is actually rather slow, and then all of a sudden at the end we get really discouraged because we're 14 assignments behind or whatever. And you know, I don't, with the asynchronous mode, I would be inclined to be very structured with the students, saying at this point you probably should be here, and at this point, so you're giving these markers, because I assume it's some sort of time limit, because sure. I don't, like, you know, most students I think you're more in the K-12 environment, but most people are kind of on automatic mode, right? I show up to school, I go to period when I go to this class, teacher arranges it all for me. I don't have to. When you're doing asynchronously, you're actually the master of your ship, you know, and that's a lot of responsibility for, as particularly for younger kids who may not have the executive skills or metacognitive skills to actually keep on track and get things done. So
I wonder what that environment is I'm describing then. You know, it almost seems, okay, so back in that scenario I presented you, 20 kids going into a classroom at a specified time, period mm-hmm. one,
let's yeah.
They all sit down. They're doing different stuff. So some kids are in the same, let's say five of those students are working in algebra, but they're all in different places in that algebra. But then another five are working in a social studies course. They're all in different places in that social studies course. So I'm trying to understand what box that fits in, synchronous, asynchronous. So it's
that's an interesting model. I haven't that exists, does it, where people do this? Or
Dr. K, I will tell you that that model is happening across the United States.
It's a funny
countless
model.
Countless schools.
You're literally creating you're going back to the little schoolhouse, aren't you? The one room schoolhouse where everybody's at a different, I mean, not quite at that range, right? But it was in a rural place and there wasn't enough people to have grades. So they all just went in and they didn't have obviously online stuff, but the idea that they're all learning at different things and different paces and such. I'm assuming that these students are at a similar grade level. Would that be correct or no?
I would say typically yes. So within that sort of general model, what you might have is, from my experience, of course, I'm only talking from my experience. You might have, so some classes might be, you know, I am a math teacher. I'm a certified math teacher, let's say, and all my kids in this class are all taking algebra. That is, I think, less common than the other scenario where you've got, you know, I'm a certified math teacher and I'm overseeing this class of students who are taking courses online. Now, there's a reason they're all learning something different is because they're recovering credits.
Got it. See.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I think that the school wouldn't prefer it that way, but then you have, right, you've got 30 kids and I don't have teachers to teach them, for them to be in a traditional classroom again.
It's too expensive to teach three kids or something like that. Yeah.
Sure.
So that's a kind of a fun problem, right? You're sort of thinking, well, how would we deal with that kind of situation? And I guess I'd want to know maybe if there were some commonalities with some students, because you could maximize that kind of benefit. I think because it's online, there's a natural maximizing of who's out there. Like as an instructor of an online course, because you're there supervising, but you're not part of that online course. They do that. Someone is responsible for that course, I think, to respond to something that's going, like they have organized the course. That course organizer could do a lot more than what is traditionally, you know. So when my students come in, my higher education students, I give them, there's an entry survey because they're all over in terms of their interests. And some people are teaching kindergarten, some people are higher education, some people are IT professionals. So I ask them about those things. And then I kind of group them a little bit because sometimes I think, okay, those people probably have common interests. And so in doing that, then sometimes I can maximize the benefit of that because I think when you're learning online, the problem for especially younger students is getting help or scaffolding when you need it. And it's a little tricky for the teacher in there who may be, as you say, they may be understand whatever's going on, but they might not. And then part of the problem is, I guess, designing the course. So I don't know how your courses are designed, but I'm watching more and more of the courses, particularly for online virtual high schools. I'm not impressed the way they may be ministry approved, but I just looked at this course in computer science, a course that would be really well supported by videos. There are many videos out there that one could use to learn Java programming or whatever, and specific routines and things. And if someone really spent some good time referring and developing that kind of a resource, that would be really helpful for students, because students really do learn there's a lot of learning with videos, a lot. But if you're going to give me a dump of text and ask me to read that, well, it's not that we we shouldn't be able to read, but it's that's not the way to learn a procedural kind of task. You have to think about that. So part of the, my answer is it's the design of the courses themselves could be much better, I would suggest, mm-hmm. so that students could be maybe have a few resources to go to before they struggle and they can't get the support that they want. Like what I guess my question to you is what are the challenges in that class, and what is it? Is it because it's such a big variety that students can't get answers or
no? So there's a few, I think, and I think that you gave some really good advice already. I think that this idea that there is some scheduled meeting time to take stock of where students are at and if they're having any trouble. Difficult, let's say, or maybe not so difficult in a class of students that are, some of them are on the same course and others are on others, mm-hmm. you can still do check-ins and say, okay, we're gonna come and sit up at the table. Where are you at? Where are you at? Let's talk. Do you have any questions as of today? Where are you at? And at least those students can speak. One mm-hmm. student may be ahead and might be able to help, you know, the student that's behind. But just to kind of step back and say, okay, come out of the internet and let's talk about where mm-hmm. you're at. And if you feel like you're supported, right, we can take that time to interview students and learn about how they're feeling. I really like that idea. I'm sure that's happening in some places. I'm sure that's not happening in some places, mm-hmm. right? I think you touched on another idea that relates to an issue in those classrooms where students are retrieving credit online, and that's, can I get the help I need when I need it? You know, that in that sort of facilitator model, I mean, it's inherent because I'm not an expert in every single subject mm-hmm. area, right? And I'm a math teacher. If a student wanted to ask me questions about Shakespeare, I don't know if I'd do it justice, right? And so trying to build in a system where, you know, support is clearly communicated to the student. They know where they can get help, number one, in real life, in the classroom, at the school. Is there tutoring available? Is there someone I can reach out to? Can I reach out to a language arts teacher here at the school if I struggle? But additionally, I like this idea of additional scaffolds right in the system. So, hey, it was presented in this way. I'm not really getting it. Are there any other resources here in front of me? Okay, I want to watch a video on it. I want to watch this. Are there any other presentations of that content that I can engage right now? Because I kind of don't get it, or I kind of didn't like that video I just watched. Again, that something like that obviously comes down to, right, we've got companies developing this content, so it's money and it's time and it's, but I think that that's a great point as well. And I think
I was just going to say that when you said companies are designing the courses, that can be a concern, and nothing necessarily wrong with companies. I'm sure they're getting some educational advice, but sometimes courses are designed to be as efficient and as consistent as possible. And that's not necessarily what students need. I just wanted to also comment the one thing that you want to, and this can be a really wonderful opportunity for students online, is, and I don't know if you do it in a course or whether you has develop an attitude, is helping them help themselves. And so we're in a world where I can tell you, and something that they're engaged in, if they're trying to, you know, playing Worlds of Warcraft or some sort of game and they want to find something out, I can tell you many are going to be very resourceful in trying to find out. And, you know, you do a Google search to start, but then you can start to kind of gauge and how do you get this information. And you don't want students doing that all the time because it can be very tiring, but it is important. It's a critical skill now for students to be able to kind of look up information assess it and see if they can help themselves. I mean, that's a pretty critical skill that we're absolutely ignoring, really, if we go through our education. I don't know about your education system, but it's more of a information out there, do the test, some interactivity, but it's not, hey, what do you think? How would you find out about that? You know, true sort of real-world learning where the answers might not be there, you know.
Sure.
Now, that's actually really useful to do. So it could be used as an opportunity. It's a little tricky with younger students, but...
It's tricky. So I want to just comment on a couple of things you said. So when I just want to see if you feel any different after I shared this piece of information with you. So like I can't speak for any other sort of technology company that does digital curriculum or that does technology solutions for education. But like, for instance, our company anyway is a company of educators, right? So, I mean, 90% of our staff are former educators. And so the people creating the language arts content are, you know, certified language arts teachers, the people, right? So it's not like a business venture corporation, right? I'm a former teacher. So we're all former teachers. So when we, you know, service schools, professional development, the solutions we're creating, we are former teachers, but at the same time, we do user groups with schools and teachers, and we incorporate what they're looking for back in, right? So it's as agile as it can be. And so I think that's important, right? So that's an evaluation tool, right? If you want to sell me a tech product, talk to me about the people that work for you. Are they educators? Do they even understand us? I think that's a good idea. Also, help themselves. So we could talk forever. Students helping themselves. One thing that we see K-12 that you may not see, well, you probably see in higher ed, but students in higher ed are a little more, they can control themselves a little better, is that, you know, schools that do like digital curriculum online, they want to lock down the internet. How can you allow a student to go help themselves and track down resources? And if the internet's locked down, and for good reason, because you turn your back and the kid's been on Facebook for 30 minutes. So it's a unique problem, right? Now, of course, if there's a library at the school, or if there is some other resource where they could find resources for themselves, right? It's tough.
Well, when I first entered into, about 20 years ago, when technology was just being introduced, was that kind of fear of what students are going to be doing. And you know, I think it's probably best to work on creating the culture of learning rather than the banning of websites and materials. I mean, the idea of restricting the internet is I understand why. Obviously, for younger kids and such, there can be some issues, of course, and for older kids, you know. But it's also understanding, and I, you know, that may be my idealism, but that people intrinsically, little people, they need to also understand the social rules. Just like when you walk into a classroom, you don't just take your shirt off and you don't start smashing people in the head. And there's lots of conventions that we expect them to behave, and they will do that. And it is the same, I think, with technology, and that, you know, you might do this at home. This might be where but we're now in a place of learning. And so these are our expectations. You're not going to get very far if you're just hours and hours on Facebook. And part of that also is a nice little, it's like the canary in the coal mine. If somebody is doing that kind of stuff, then in class, you know, then that's a real indication that what's going on isn't particularly interesting. So, you know, you can adjust in a classroom if, you know, they're using cell phones or whatever. But, and I'm not saying it's easy, you know, it's always easy to not easy, but it the simple solution is lock it all down. Nobody gets through. That's simple. It's just, even as a parent, no, you're not doing what? Because I said so. And that's, I'm not sure how that's actually helping anybody. And in fact, what it does for students is it just makes them like, how do I get around this? And you know, we teach them that way, but they become good problem solvers that way. And don't tell me that all the blocking, they're going to find the five kids in the school that know how to get around this, and it becomes this game. And a lot of time and energy is put towards that, other than saying, look, this is our expectations. And if you can't act properly, then, you know, there are consequences, as there would be in society. You know, if you are tackling people and you're, or, you know, there, you can't do these things. It's by agreement. It's social agreement. It's not. So I find it's when you're restricting something like the internet, that's like, wow, that's a strange idea. Because, you know, to do that, I mean, it's not strange, obviously. I understand why, because they could come across these sites and you wouldn't want certain sites. And I get sometimes
they're cheating, right? They're just going to look there. They're going to find,
right,
you know, YouTube, and someone's like, hey, I'm also using that same system, and like, here are the answers, right? So, yeah. And it's also time wasting too, you know?
Right. And the cheating is a kind, like, if you can cheat, then, like, if I'm giving you something so simple that you can go cheat and just copy it down, then really what I'm, you know, not shame on me, but I really haven't given you something engaging enough to do. When I did assignments, for example, I didn't give everybody the same assignment. I was lucky enough to have computer studies and such that I was teaching. Is they had to create, you know, what is it they wanted to do? I set some parameters, but they picked it. And that actually eliminated the copying, because they, you know, you can't always do that. I understand that. But going through a, you know, sometimes mundane task where you're copying and pasting, it's probably telling you that that's actually probably not the most interesting thing for them to do. And they're not learning. It's a game for them. And so that's a systemic problem of the kind of content and curriculum that we should have. That's a bigger issue.
So final question here. I literally could talk to you for the next three hours, but final question. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on how the teacher role is changing. How do you see, is it changing? What do you think what sort of characteristics do you think it will take on as we continue to leverage technology to teach?
Well, that's a very good question, because in general, education is remarkably resistant to change, startlingly so in some ways. There are innovators and pockets of exciting things that are being done. And then there's this very large resistant force that is continuing with the ways of hundreds of years ago. And I would suggest you go into any high school classroom. I can't speak for the United States, and every state's different, and I'm sure there's some amazing things going on, but it's probably fairly consistent that there's a kind of a lecture-based approach being done, particularly with the level of content demanded from the teacher. The fastest way to quote cover this stuff is to kind of present it, and then you do some worksheets, and we might do some labs, but it's very conventional kinds of things. Now, that's, and honestly, I used to tell my students, you know, it's kind of the easiest way to teach. You know, it's if you think about the effort required, that's probably the easiest approach, is a lecture, and then here's what I know it already, I don't really. And now that's more of a cynical perspective. And so I think but I do believe that there's a group that and a large group that aren't changing, but I also believe that there's this other group that's, you know, in terms of what is changed, what could be, some innovative stuff is that we're shifting the role of learning to the student. And the guide on the side and those kinds of things. But you look at Mark Prensky's stuff, I would suggest that's probably the kind of roles, particularly with technology, where you're setting up situations. It's problem-based learning. The teacher kind of sets up the scenarios, but then gives a lot of choice and decision to a group that has to work collaboratively. It's the difference between a group work where he's like, oh, I have to do this, and one person does all the work, versus we have to work as a team here because we can't possibly get this done individually. It's too much, and we need this discussion. And I'm sure you've experienced it. You have your team there where you go in with some different ideas, and somebody has some different ideas, and then you come out with way better ideas than yours and way better than theirs, because that's a really good feeling. And so to set up those kind of problem-based scenarios where students are working on authentic problems, complex problems, and the teacher is acting as a resource on the side, setting things up, also a questioner, asking questions. Those are, and obviously the quality assurance, because in my, not all students are going to be on task or being able to figure out what's going on, so they can come in. So I think that's sort of my ideal scenario. But I you asked, like, in what way are teachers changing? I think the demands on teachers are really excessive, and therefore it makes it very difficult for them to do something creative and to change. And I'll give you an example. In a typical classroom that we have in Ontario, where I'm in Canada, in a K to 8 classroom, you might have, well, actually often there's a split classroom. We have this strange thing where you do 3-4 splits or 4-5 splits or whatever. So you have 10 students or 12 students from grade 4. So then all of a sudden they're doing 2 curricula. And then within that class, there's probably 4 or 5 identified students who need extra assistance. And there's probably another 3 or 4 that haven't been identified. And so then they have to meet all those individual needs and try to organize. And maybe they have an assistant to help, an educational assistant. And then to add on top of it, they have to refer to like 6 or 7 subject areas and be specially, and this is a lot to ask of any human being to do well. It's remarkable that they do what they do. So then we say, what do they have to do? Well, the system is constraining them so much. Imagine the different scenario where you're math only. You're that's what you do from K to 8, and you're the specialist there, and you have to see the development of mathematical concepts, and you watch kids go through, and that could be that's a whole different game where you get to concentrate your energies a little bit differently, and even focus a bit more. So this is not a knock against teachers. I work in a faculty of education. I love new teachers, and we try to inspire them of what we want them to do. But the system is constraining, and there are, and I'll end with this. A quick example is standardized testing, which we didn't have 5 years ago or 6 years ago in Ontario. Maybe we did, maybe 8 years ago. Anyway, it came in relatively recently. And then, oddly enough, like 45 minutes a day was being devoted to preparing for this test school-wide. Like, so that, and I just thought, oh, goodness, this is the opposite of what you want, because it made a difference. But it actually makes no difference in terms of salary or anything here, but I guess performance from a principal or something. It's more of a political thing, I guess. But that's a systematic thing, a systemic thing that really can undermine the wonderful things that teachers could do. Because I think teachers really want to be creative. I think they want to do exciting things, many of them. But there's a lot of constraints. The environment, we talked about learning environment, the teaching environment is pretty constrained. And the ones that break through are they have a lot of energy, and they really, I guess, you know, push the limits. But you would, I think if you asked them, they would have said it's definitely been, it would have been a struggle. So it's not really an easy answer for you, I guess. I would love to say yes, we've moved from lecturing to being guides and stuff, but I don't necessarily think that's the case. Although with online learning, it probably a little bit more so.
Dr. K, I really appreciate the time that you spent with us today. Thank you for your contributions to the field. Thank you for talking with me. It was a real pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Edmentum Podcast. Let us know your thoughts by sharing with us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Follow us on SoundCloud and stay tuned for upcoming episodes.